Good morning. There are sheets over here, somewhere around the middle of the table. And if you did not sign in, I'm going to ask that you please do so, because I always need to follow up after the shiur with questions that come up in the course of the shiur. So if you don't have the sign-in sheet, can someone tell me where the sign-in sheet is? Okay, sign-in sheet is over there. Okay. So please make sure to pass the sign-in sheet around. Thank you. I'm grateful to Michael Mammon, Alana Aziza, and Bayit Adult Education for co-sponsoring the shiur this morning. Our topic is refusing medical treatment or refusing to follow medical advice. And the way I want to do this is to break it down into three parts. The first part being, what is considered medical advice in the first place? What qualifies as medical advice? The second part, a brief question of whether a patient is allowed to seek a second opinion. And this one, I think many people might consider sort of a no-brainer, but nonetheless, I've been asked the question, so I'd like to address it. I think it's an interesting question. And then third, what reasons might justify or not justify rejecting medical advice? In the course of this, we'll touch on a couple of tangential things along the way. One thing I do want to note, as always, is that for practical halachic questions, one must consult one's shul rabbi. Okay. So, a stipulation first, because we've discussed this in many other sessions, and I don't want to spend the time on it right now. The stipulation that a Jew is obligated to seek medical help in general. In other words, the question of, are we obligated to actually talk to doctors in the first place, and maybe we could just rely on God for miracles, is something that I don't want to revisit and reopen at the moment. The Torah tells us, "V'nishmartem ma'od l'nafsho seichem," you are required to guard your lives, and it says, "V'nishmartem ma'od," you shall guard well, you shall guard greatly, I suppose, your lives. We have a principle in halacha, chamira sakanta me'isura. It is more important to stay away from a dangerous situation than it is to stay away from violating a prohibition. And it's clear in the Gemara, it's clear in the Shulchan Aruch, that we go to doctors for medical advice regarding, for example, the Gemara in Yuma, Pei Gimel, that talks about eating on Yom Kippur and the question of whether one needs to eat or not. It talks about consulting a physician regarding the issue of violating Shabbos to take care of a patient to save somebody. Body's life. You know, if someone could maybe hit that door, that would be great. Thank you. It sits Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg. Actually, I brought it here in source number one as just as one formulation of the principle that we do, in fact, rely on physicians. He says, "Mikevan shalafi mitzius hadvarim dekimad ruba deruba divnei adam einam zakayim lekach shatavu rufuasam ayidei neis min hashamayim." He says, in reality, he says, almost the great majority of people, I'm not even sure why it's an almost, but he says, almost the great majority of people do not merit to be healed via miracles from heaven. So he says, and he says, the Torah itself doesn't say that our laws depend on miracles, that you should follow the laws even to the extent of relying on a miracle. So he says, when the Torah gives permission to doctors to heal, a topic we're going to return to a little bit later, that is also permission to the patient to pursue healing. One shouldn't think that permission to doctors to heal means that God says, if somebody comes to you, you're allowed to take care of them, but they weren't supposed to come to you in the first place. No, they are certainly entitled to do so. He says, not only that, it's a mitzvah, and it is an obligation for people to go to the doctor. So this is something I'm stipulating from the get-go, rather than revisit and reopen the questions that are involved behind it. Moshe Feinstein has a ruling on it as well. But I'd like to accept it as a given. The first question then, as I said at the outset, is what exactly constitutes medical advice? When we talk about relying on a doctor and the doctor gives you advice, what exactly is included in that? So as a general rule, when we approach medicine, we look for medicine for which we have proper testing and experience that demonstrates that it works. And I'm not talking about the doctor now. I'm talking about the treatment. We look for We look for treatment that has been tested and shown to work. And that we have numerous sources on this matter. The Rivash, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Sheshet Perfed, writing back in the 15th century, discussed this in the case in which medical wisdom challenged halachic principle. There was a certain principle that was dictated or expected based on our traditional sources, and the standard medical position seemed to be in conflict with the position of our tradition. And his answer was, the Rivash's answer in part was, you know what, these doctors will say anything, and they're not necessarily relying on proper testing, and therefore they don't necessarily know. The assumption was that if there, you know, the assumption seems to be that if we are to call something proper medicine, there has to be some kind of testing involved. And the Chasam Sofer, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, writing in the 18th century in source number 2, says, Vanisayon, who aid Ne'eman, Yoser Mikol HaSvaros HaBinuyos Al Rayos. He says, experience is a more honest witness than all the theories founded on all the proofs in the world. However many proofs somebody is going to seek to bring, ultimately what we rely on is whether medicine has been tested. If it's been tested, then we consider it to be sound. Now, the definition of what testing looks like is an interesting question. So that the Gemara talks about tested medicine as something which has been tested 3 times, and 3 times in a row it worked on a similar patient, and that's a valid test. Today we have all sorts of fun in defining tests and double blind and whatnot. And these are good discussions, but the standards fundamentally are going to be whatever is considered the norm in medical practice. And I'm going to come back to that in a little bit to unpack that a little bit more. But first I wanted to show you what the Rambam, what Maimonides did with this. Maimonides, you're probably well aware, is a rationalist. He likes that which he can understand, that which he can explain. And that's what he's apt to endorse. But he reads the Gemara, and he finds that when the Talmud discusses medicines, while it discusses sometimes medicines that we understand, that we're able to explain, sometimes it discusses things that just seem weird. That's the technical term. They'll talk about shein shel shu'al, a fox's tooth, being used for medication, or masmer min hatsaluv, or a splinter taken from the gallows on which somebody was hung. Like very, very strange, out there ideas, which generally speaking are considered pagan and quasi-idolatrous. And yet some of these actually are mentioned. One of them, eating the liver of a dog. If someone was bit by a dog, eating from the liver of the dog. This is not early Louis Pasteur and rabies vaccine. That's not what this is. What it is strange. And the Rambam says we can't explain why it should work. And therefore, theoretically, according to his system, it should be forbidden under the law that's called Darkei Amori, which prohibits pagan practices. But the Gemara talks about using it. So how do you justify prescribing something that you can't explain logically? So take a look at source number 3, where the Rambam, Maimonides, writes the following in his Guide of the Perplexed. He has another similar piece in his Perushim Mishnayos, his commentary to the Mishnah, but I felt that this piece captured it very well. He says, Va'amru b'feirush, kol sheyesh bo mishum refua, ein bo mishum darkei amori. He says, the sages have said explicitly that if something is medical, then we don't prohibit it as Amorite ways of the pagan Amori nation. Rotzim bazeh, what they mean by that is to say, shekoma shiigzireyu ha'iyun hativi hu mutar vizulaso asur. He says anything which is mandated by natural examination, natural study. In other words, our scientific theories indicate that such is going to be accepted, is going to work, I should say. So that's permitted, and otherwise it's going to be prohibited. So then he asks, "Val yiksha alecha ma shehitiru mehem b'masmerat saluv v'shein hashu'al." He says, "Don't be troubled by the fact that they permitted use of the masmerat saluv. The masmer is I made reference to a splinter before. I shouldn't have. It's a nail from a saluv. Sliva is crucifixion. A practice which does not originate with early Christianity, but was a Roman method of execution. So I'm talking about using the nail from from this setup on which he was crucified, Bishena Shuala, the fox's tooth. He says, in their day, they thought that these, in fact, had been tested, that it had been used and it worked, and therefore, this is shown to be a valid, uh, a medical treatment. Sorry. Either that or Nishtatani Sayon. Zev suggests maybe nature has changed. It worked once and it doesn't work now. I think odds are the experimental method may have changed. But he writes, Ki kol mashnis ameis nisyono be'elu, afo pishalo yigzireyu ha-hekesh, hu mutar la'asoso. Because he fundamentally says, anything that is validated by experience, even if logic doesn't dictate it should work, is going to be permitted. The bottom line is, do you find that it works or not? Which makes sense, because if your fundamental concern is, can I explain it or not, we've had numerous treatments, like penicillin is the classic that gets mentioned, we've had numerous types of therapies and treatments which have been discovered to work before we could explain how they worked. They were fully scientific, there was nothing idolatrous or pagan about it. So if you can find it to work, gesunde hate, so to speak. That was his statement, and in fact, contemporary authorities have relied on this. Rav Rabinovitz, in an article in Halacha Refuah, Rav Elyashiv, quoted in the work Aleinu L'Shabeach, talk about accepting what they call refuah sigulit, a medical treatment which we can't explain scientifically, but we know it works. And saying, okay, on that basis, we're going to go ahead with it. So when it comes to medicine, we generally look for medicine for which we have some kind of experience indicating, yes, this works. But what about certifying a doctor? It's a lot trickier when you're dealing with a doctor, right? When you're dealing with a medical trial, so you get to choose the patients who fit the protocol, right? And you can weed out the ones who don't fit for a variety of reasons, and perhaps the ones whose condition is so dire that they're going to bias the study, because the treatment won't work for them, but would work for someone who wasn't so far along, right? You can control it much better. A doctor doesn't get the opportunity to do that. So how exactly do we determine that this doctor works? Is it just based on the cure ratio? That's it. Is that how we're going to do it? So the answer is clearly not. The standard that's given in halacha, in Jewish law, is actually relatively vague. We require that he be an expert. That's our standard. Has to be an expert. No word on who says the person is an expert in the initial sources. If you take a look at source number 4, a quote that we're going to come back to a little bit later as well, the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, writes, Lo yis'aseg berefuah, ela im kein hu baki. One should not involve himself in healing unless he is an expert. The latter part of this we have to come back to. He says, Velo yeisham gadol mimenu. And by the way, there should be no greater doctor around. So you have to be the best. Shem lo kein, because if not, harei ze shofech damim. If not, he is a shedder of blood. Parenthetically, here on this point, but you have to be an expert. The Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, in his Nishmas Avram in Yeradeya Shin Lamed Vav, has a short paragraph which is just very, very sharp regarding lay people who give medical advice. He says he can't believe how many times in his practice he saw lay people prescribe antibiotics for people and say, oh yeah, I know, you should have this, you should have that. He says, the Shulchan Aruch says, I'm raising shofech damim, and that's called murder. You have to know what you're doing in order to be able to do this. So the rule, in fact, is, yes, one is supposed to be an expert. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his Moruk Tzia, writing in the 18th century, the Moruk Tzia is a work by Rabbi Emden, which is a commentary to the Tur, an early code of Jewish law. So the source I brought you in source number 5 is from where he discusses the issues of healing on Shabbos. And he writes, Av hastamit al yidei rofe mumche kevada'it chashiva. He says, even an unknown treatment, meaning a treatment we don't know for sure works, if it's prescribed by an expert physician, then we consider it to be definite. We treat it as authoritative. But again, he doesn't explain what expert means. We get a little more explanation by the Levush, a halachic authority writing in the 16th century. He says you have to be expert in the particular field involved, whatever the illness is. We're not talking about a broad, this person is an expert in medicine. You have to be an expert regarding that particular illness. But that still doesn't really explain it. So what is an expert such that one is credible to provide medical advice? How many years do they have to study? What do they have to study? Do they need practical experience? What is the standard? So Fortunately for us, we didn't come along and standardize it, but the secular authorities came along and standardized it. So take a look in source number 6, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, writing in the 18th century, in his commentary to a work of law called the Birkei Yosef, which is also his own work, he says, V'hayom, today, hey, today being the 18th century, She'ein shum adam yachol l'rapos ki im birshus chachameihem. No one is allowed to treat patients without license from their scholars. Theirs meaning the general world. There are people who are authorized to license doctors. Stam kol eiz kol osek berufua nikra mumcha. Anybody who is involved in medicine is assumed to be an expert, because he has to be licensed. So what he's really saying is, anybody who is licensed is considered to be an expert. And he's quoting here someone named the Maharil of Wali. I have not been able to track down who that is. I don't know. But if the Chidah, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, is comfortable with him, that goes a long way. We find this echoed in the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, writing in Novarduk in the early 20th century, the first years of the 20th century. He said the same thing. He said an expert, somebody who has government approval, is accepted. And this is quoted by Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham as well in his Nishmas Avram. The Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, writing about 20 years ago, expanded on this idea of whatever is normal being trusted when he discussed the issue of a physician who harms a patient. And he quoted Ramban, Nachmanides, on this in source number 7. I'm going to explain it outside of Ramban's text first, because I couldn't bring the entire discussion there, and then we'll see it inside. Ramban is bothered by the following. We have a passage in the Gemara, a passage in the Talmud that says that a physician, as I mentioned earlier, is licensed to heal. Right? Nitna rishus larope larabos. Because the Torah says that if one person harms another person, then he has an obligation to make it right in 5 different ways. He has to take care of the person's lost wages, he has to take care of depreciation, and so on. One of the ways in which he has to take care of the victim is medical bills. The Torah says, v'rapo yirape. He has to heal the victim of his attack. So the Gemara on that, the Talmud says, oh, you see that the Torah recognizes such a thing as medical treatment. Nitna rishus larope larapos, which leads the commentators to ask, why did you need permission to heal? We're obligated. You shall not stand by as the blood of your brother is shed. You have an obligation to take care of others. There are numerous biblical mitzvot that surround healing. So why would I have thought otherwise? So there are a few different explanations. But one explanation that's offered, and this is favored by Ramban, by Nachmanides in the 13th century, is that it means to say that even though when you go heal people, sometimes it doesn't work out the way you planned and you can end up actually harming the patient, nonetheless, you are licensed to engage in the attempt to heal. That's the way that Ramban, Nachmanides, understands it. So he takes it essentially as indemnification of the physician, saying that you can do what you're supposed to do, and you will not be responsible in the event that it goes bad. So he's bothered, because there's a teaching that goes back 2,000 years ago to a Tosafta, which says that if a doctor is attempting to treat a patient and the patient dies, the doctor goes to the Ir Miklat, goes to the city of refuge, which is a place for people who killed accidentally. He says, you just indemnified the physician. The physician. You just said that he's not going to be responsible. So why is he going off to the city of refuge? He should be able to stay home. He should be innocent of any charge. How do I understand the competing sources? So take a look at source number 7 where you get his response. Ramban writes, Harofe kidayan mitzuveli don. He says a doctor is like a judge. A judge has a mitzvah. He is required to judge. V'im tav b'lo hoda, ein alav onesh klal. If he makes a mistake, but he doesn't know that he has made a mistake, he has no punishment. Kidayan, read it, he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin to that effect. Ein l'dayan ela mashe inav ro'os. A judge only has that which his eyes see. You work with the best means you have at your disposal, and that's all you can do. And if you make a mistake, he says, there's no punishment. However, im tav noda lebeisin sheta, if he made a mistake and the court finds out the judge has made a mistake, then mishalimi beiso al adrachim hayiduim bo, then he has to pay in the known manner that's prescribed for repaying the litigant if the judge made a mistake. So he says, in the event that it becomes known that he made a mistake, he is going to be responsible. Now, there are two different ways you can take what Ramban is saying here. One is the most literal, the other is, I think, the correct way. The most literal read of what Ramban is saying is that, I'm applying it to the physician now as opposed to the judge, the most literal read is, if the physician did the best he could, and he made a mistake, but he doesn't know he made a mistake. In other words, sometimes the patient dies even though you did everything as it was supposed to be just because of some other factor in the patient's health, because the treatment itself is dangerous, it's the way it goes. So if the physician did everything to the letter of the law, and then the patient died anyway, then the physician is not responsible. And even if it was the physician's mistake, the physician is still not responsible. However, if the physician finds out that he made a mistake, then he's going to be liable. That's the literal way to read Ramban. The problem with that is that I don't understand the logic. Either you made a mistake or you didn't make a mistake. If you made a mistake, then you're telling me I'm liable if I found out about it. I should be liable even if I didn't find out about it. It's just that no one's going to take me to court for it because no one knows. So I think there's another way to read Ramban. And I think it's sustainable based on how others have taken Ramban as well, which is that what he's suggesting is that we distinguish not between whether you found out or didn't find out. We distinguish between whether you made a mistake or whether it's simply that the treatment didn't work. And what he's saying is, if the treatment was done properly and it didn't work, you're not liable. If you found out you made a mistake, meaning that you didn't apply it correctly, you did something wrong, that's when there's going to be liability. Granted, you're still obligated to treat, but you're going to be innocent of liability unless it turns out that you actually did something wrong. The upshot of this is somewhat tangential. The reason I'm bringing it is because of the principle that he invoked here in source number 7. The principle he invoked here was, a judge only has that which his eyes see. Meaning, applying it to medicine, a doctor does whatever medicine normally prescribes. That's what we consider to be medical advice. When I said earlier that a patient is obligated to go ask for advice from the physician, the physician simply gives whatever is considered to be normal medical advice. That's it. Yes?
It's very hard to work that in practical terms.
Yeah.
It would mean that a judge whose case is taken on to appeal and overturned on a law basis, is reading out a law, the primary judge would be liable.
And that's in fact what Jewish law states. That if the judge makes what's called taos bidvar mishnah, he makes a mistake on core information of the law, as opposed to a misunderstanding of his particular application to the circumstance here, then he is going to be liable in Jewish law. There are nuances to it, because there are nuances to everything, but we distinguish between what's called Tav Bidvar Mishnah versus Tav B'Shikul Hadas, a distinction between a mistake in which he didn't know the basic code versus a mistake in terms of weighing the opinions involved in the application to the case at hand. But yes, that's true. That may make it difficult in practice. I'm not disagreeing. One more note, just on this idea that we go with the expert who offers whatever is conventional medical wisdom. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, writing in the late 20th century, also presented this in source number 8. After he presents a series of views regarding a physician's liability for error, he says, Hatzad HaShaveh, he says, the common denominator among all these views that he had cited, as long as the doctor intends to heal, based on the medical methods that he possesses, mutar, he is permitted to do it. Umitzvah biyado l'rabo says hachola al pi shitas harefuah mekubelas l'ripui machala zos. It is a mitzvah for him to treat this patient according to the received medical approach for this illness. Whatever, not received is the wrong word really. Mekubelas is the Hebrew. I should have said accepted. That's a better translation here than received. The accepted medical approach for this illness. On this point, what do you do if there's a dispute among the physicians? In other words, it's very easy to sit here and say the accepted medical view, right? That may work when you're talking about, I don't know, treating strep throat. So maybe there's an accepted order of antibiotics to use. But what do you do when you get into more complicated medical cases? And one doctor says this, and one doctor says that. Now what is accepted medical opinion? So the Shvus Yaakov, Rabbi Yaakov Reischer, writing in 17th century Prague, offered an approach which is quoted by many contemporary authorities. The Hebrew is on one side, the English is on the top of the other side. It's source number 9. He says, "Benidon zeh," in this case, and he's dealing with a surgery situation that was meant to save someone's life. So he says, "Kevan shevada yamus," since the patient we're talking about is definitely going to die without the surgery. Meaning, they're comfortable saying, despite the fact that we always say in Judaism and in Jewish law that there's always a chance, nonetheless, the doctors say he's dying if he doesn't have this treatment, and we're accepting that for the purposes of this responsum. So, "Kevan shevada yamus, manichin havadai, betosin asafek, ula yisrape." So we leave the certainty, meaning we don't want this person to die, and therefore we will take the possibility, uncertain as it is, that he might live, because it might work. Umikal makom ein lasos harofei kipshuto kain. But he says the doctor should not simply do this. Or alternatively, he's saying rofei kipshuto, a simple doctor shouldn't just do this. Rak tzarech lios matunim meod badavar. He says you have to be very patient with this. Lefakeach im rofin mumchin shebeir al pi rov deos. He has to check with expert doctors in the city and follow the majority view. Dehainu ruba de minkar shu kefel. And he says the majority means a recognizable majority, which is double. He's borrowing a term from kashrus. The idea of ruba de minkar is if you have 3 items in a mixture and the permitted items are double the prohibited items. In other words, there are 2 permitted items and 1 prohibited item. That's called a recognizable majority. So 2 versus 1 is double. So he says, that's what I want. I want a 2-to-1 ratio prescribing this dangerous treatment before we're going to say to go ahead with it. Because you have to worry about people who don't take things seriously. He says you have to work with the majority view among doctors and the agreement of the leading local authority. That's what he wants you to go with. But the upshot of this is that there is something called standard medical practice that is recognized in Jewish law, such that that's what this a patient is supposed to go looking for. Standard medical practice. Now, I sent an email last night to Rabbi Dr. Abraham because I was wondering, if I get an answer from it, I will send to the group of people who are here, which is a good opportunity to remind people to sign in. Please pass around the sign-in sheet. I'm not sure why this is true. I'm not sure why there is this thing we call standard medical opinion that we're going to rely on. Is it simply because, well, that's the best we can do? It's not clear to me. I can offer a few different rationales. One rationale would be, because the pasuk, the verse we quoted regarding the judge. You go to the judge, asher yeyeh bayamim ahem, whoever's around in those days. So that's your standard. That's one possibility. A second possibility is because Shomer Psayim Hashem. We have a general principle that as long as you conduct yourself in whatever is considered the normal way, that it's God's responsibility to protect you from problems. God guards people who are foolish, is the biblical verse, but the idea that emerges from it is that as long as what people are doing is sort of the norm, then God is going to take care of them. It's his responsibility. So I wonder if it's not from that. Or maybe it's because God licensed doctors to heal. Therefore, clearly, he expects them to use whatever is normal for doctors. That could be why. I'm not sure what the reason is within our system for why we just assume that the standard way is the way. But that's the weight of the sources that I just brought you. Not only that, yes.
Just a question. Yeah.
Good. Excellent question. Hang in there because I'm getting to that. Excellent question. But just to build up this expertise issue for a moment before we get there, you can take a look ahead at source number 13 if you want, and that's the source where we get in trouble. But but in terms of this, we keep mentioning expert. I've also mentioned the local expert in particular, and that's something that was stressed by the Rambam, by Maimonides. I brought you one example of it in source number 10 in his Laws of Shabbat. He says, "Osin lo kol tzrachav b'Shabbat." He says, if you're dealing with a patient who is dangerously ill, you do whatever his needs are on Shabbos. Al pi rofei uman shel oso makom, based on the expert doctor in that place. You go with whoever is there. And that's seen in numerous sources down until our own day. Why the local expert? So source number 11, Rabbeinu Manoach of Narbonne, writing in the 13th century, explained very simply, it's that verse that we quoted regarding judges. You go to the judge, Asher Yehiyah Bayamim Ahim, who's there in those days. We only can expect you to work with the one you have locally. Yes?
So, I really wanted to ask this question earlier, but I think it's relevant again here. The expert in that place, that's very nice if you're in Smithville, Ontario, but if you're even there, there's going to be a lot of doctors, and one's the expert. And you said before, you have to be the expert, and anyone else, if you're not, it's just shrikat damim.
Yes.
So that means there could really be only one doctor. He's got to be the best, and nobody else can really heal.
Very good. So I'm hoping to get to that too. And number four, if you take a look at source 14, you'll already see it, because it's an excellent question and one that bothered me a lot and has bothered many people along the way. So we have to get to a better definition of local. And in particular, just to complicate it further, there is no true local anymore. Meaning you have the means of consulting people who live on the other side of the planet. So what does local even mean? You know, unless you're talking about when the patient comes into the ER and there's no opportunity to consult anybody, you generally speaking have greater resources at your disposal in terms of local than human beings have ever had. So I'm not sure even how to explain local, but I think that what we'll see in 14 is going to address it. It's a good question. So what do we do with this? I mean, Rav Shlomo Aviner, by the way, in an article in the journal Asya from about 25 years ago, said that if you have somebody who is certified elsewhere, he was asked a question regarding medicine that might be practiced in the Far East, but that locally doesn't have a certifying board approving it. So his statement was, you go with local authority. He said, if it's approved elsewhere, but it's not approved here, you go with your local authority. But once again, I'll stress, I think local has changed. And I'm not sure how you look at local anymore. But we're going to come back to local a little bit in a few minutes. First, I wanted to ask one more question about this certification, which is going to lead me back to Alana's question about how you get training. What about a medical intern? Right? As I understand medical internship, an intern is not licensed to practice unsupervised, but is practicing supervised on actual patients, right? Is that not correct? Right? What do you do with a resident? A resident is a doctor, right? He's called doctor, and he is let loose on the unsuspecting world in July. So what do we do there? Is that also medical advice such that the patient is obligated to go seek and follow medical advice? So I found this interesting source in source number 12. It's recorded on the website of the Association of Orthodox Jewish Scientists. It was written, according to the site, by Rabbi Moshe Tendler, as well as Dr. Fred Rosner. And according to what the site says, every single item there on that page was shown to Rabbi Moshe Feinstein and approved by him. So look at what he has to say here. The context is slightly different from our own. The context is a question, I think, based on what is written here. The context is the question of, We say a doctor should break Shabbos in order to take care of patients. What about a medical student who doesn't know everything? Should he also feel like he should break Shabbos to take care of patients? So he writes, although the student has no legal responsibility for patient care, legal meaning not Jewish law, but secular law, and although he may not have adequate knowledge to exercise mature medical judgment, his aid is often necessary and nearly always beneficial. Time is saved by the senior physician because additional hands are available. The halakha does not distinguish between medical student, clinical clerk, intern, resident, and attending physician, or even a layman, insofar as all contribute to the total patient care. The obligation to aid a dangerously ill patient falls not only on the graduate physician, but on anyone able to and asked to render assistance. Included in this obligation are first and second year medical students, and certainly third and fourth year students who possess considerable medical knowledge and are essential members of the diagnostic and therapeutic team. The source goes on to explain more about why we would look at them favorably, but the point is they are considered to be practicing medicine. They bring valuable medicine to the table, and therefore their advice should indeed be respected. Now we turn to source number 13. The source number 13 comes from Eliezer Waldenberg, and it's actually part of a two-responsum set in which he was asked the following remarkable question. Someone turned to him and said, I am a medical student. When I practice surgery, it takes longer than it does for more senior, more practiced physicians. And I don't believe in the article it actually said anything beyond that he's still practicing under supervision. So I don't know if he's an intern or resident. That's not clear to me. But I'm still learning, and therefore it takes me longer. If I'm operating on a patient using general anesthesia, and this is a patient with a sensitivity to general anesthesia, and now my surgery is going to be prolonged, am I allowed to do the surgery? Or do we say, hand this one over to a more senior person because I'm endangering the patient because my surgery takes longer? And then the follow-up question that goes with it is, what if it's not someone with a known sensitivity? But as a general rule, being under general anesthesia is considered dangerous. So I am now having this patient under general anesthesia for longer. My surgery is going to take, I'm now making up a period of time, half an hour longer than the experienced physician. Maybe I shouldn't be allowed to do this surgery. You follow the question?
And you'll never have a Jewish surgeon.
Right, so that's the question.
And he's sitting right there.
So, hang on. Take a look first at source number 13. And this is his initial response. Obviously, I'm bringing it out of I'm excerpting it from a larger discussion. But he says, Asur lo lerofei halomeid levatseyas hanituach tachas hardama klalit. He says, it is prohibited, indeed, for the physician you are describing to perform this surgery under general anesthesia. B'yos v'gorem al yedei kein lahamshachas hardama klalit asher sakana krucha b'chova. He says, he causes, via this extended general anesthesia, he causes great danger or greater danger to the patient. So the follow-up that he gets, this is exactly Alana's question from before, the follow-up question that he gets from the person he had corresponded with is, well, then you're never going to have a Jewish surgeon. He's got to learn somehow. What are you going to do? So in his response, he says a couple of interesting things. One was, he quotes a sefer called the Kol Sofer. All the doctors here are likely familiar with the Gemara at the end of the Mishnah, I should say, at the end of Kiddushin, that says, Tov Shevarofim LeGehenim, that the best of doctors is going to Gehenim. So that's what the Mishnah says. So explanations of that line abound, and we will see more of them later. But the explanation brought from this work called Sofer specifically is, how do you get to be Tov Shebarofim? How do you get to be the best of the doctors? He says, if all you do is follow established practice and you never try something on your own, you're not going to become the best of the doctors. The best of the doctors becomes that way because he went out and tried things that were daring and new. And as a result, he's going to end up in Gehenna because of all the people who had to suffer along the way for him to become the best of the doctor. That's a very harsh statement that he makes. But his prescription is, his advice to this person is, that he should only practice in settings in which there will be either a non-elevated risk. In other words, you're dealing with somebody who can deal with the slower surgery and it won't cause that risk, whether that means situations where there isn't general anesthesia, situations in which the patient really isn't at a heightened risk because of a surgery that takes half an hour longer, or situations in which he's supervised by somebody who can recognize the danger signs and intervene in the event that intervention is warranted. But that's his position. Yes? Yeah.
For instance, or a student going to assess a patient using radiation. Using radiation, even if it's in small doses, definitely, you know, over the patient's life, is it can deal with a person.
Right.
So how do you balance, or is there sort of a cutoff point where you say, okay, this is increased risk, this is marginally increased risk? Is there some sort of a yardstick, or is it a judgment call?
Right. So Alana asks, what about using radiology as an example? But I think it's a broader question, right? You know, how do you gauge what is acceptable risk and what is this inappropriate increased risk? And, you know, when you first started asking the question, I thought I was going to have to say to you, you know, I have to research this because it's not really directly on point, but I think it's exactly on point. Because I think the answer to that is exactly what we're saying. There's a medical standard. Whatever is considered to be normal and acceptable within medical practice is going to be what we're going to be comfortable with, because that's what we've been honoring all along, is saying whatever the doctors say is the right thing to do. So, for example, doctor wants to prescribe a test because he personally feels like he doesn't know, right? But maybe that test, you know, could lead to an infection or whatever it is. Maybe you should say, you know, I should be referring this out, or I shouldn't need this. If that's the norm, that's how we determine it, then that's what is accepted.
And also make the argument that the university-based teacher is theoretically the more senior and more experienced, or closer to the MUMFET, the expert. Therefore, even though you may be in the hands of his resident, at the time you're also under the supervision of the super specialist or the super skilled. So you have a trade-off in that sense.
Right.
Well, so it's yet another argument which takes us closer to help to the MUMFET.
Right. So Zev points out that working with a supervised doctor, where he's supervised by the university physician, may actually put him in a better position to be safe because of the supervision that's involved. Certainly a possibility. I defer to the doctors on this. But that's all meant to address question number one. Question number one was, what constitutes medical advice? The rest of the shiur goes a lot faster from here. But the question of what constitutes medical advice, the answer is, we go with the local certified expert. That's what we are looking to do. Because Asher Yeh Bayam Imahem, you go with the expert who will be there at that time, because this is what God licensed when he said, Rapo Yerape, this is what we do. So then, is it wrong to seek a second opinion? Is it then wrong to say, I want to go to another expert after I've heard from the first expert? And as I said, I've heard this question from quite a few people. So the answer is no. The answer is, we prefer to go with the greatest expert available. And if you have the option of going to somebody else who may tell you a better answer, better not meaning what you want to hear, but a better answer, then that's what you do. We said, in our quote from the Shulchan Aruch earlier, in source number 4, you have to go to the greatest available. So if you go to your doctor, that doesn't preclude you from seeking advice from others. Which brings me to source number 14 and the question that Dr. Justin asked before. So are you really looking for the greatest physician? What am I supposed to do in this regard, in our day? So Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, in his Tzitz Eliezer, addressed this issue in source number 14. He says, Kol shelo sipek bidei harofei hayoser gadol l'tapel b'chol acholim shebeir. He says, if the greater doctor does not have the ability to treat every local patient, right? Because you may have the greatest, you know, fill-in-the-blank specialist in the field. You may be able to go to him, and so can everybody else. But there's no way he's going to answer every email, read every x-ray, and be able to deal with the file of every patient. So if that's so, or maybe the patient doesn't have the financial ability, the financial means to go to the expert, D'azay muter letapel baze kol rofe. You know what that next word is? In the Hebrew, for the Hebrew readers. Miduplam. Miduplam. That's a great modern Hebrew word. It means you have a diploma. The miduplam. He says, Mutter letapel bazek kol rofe miduplam shekibel ksav hasmacha. He says, if your expert can't treat every patient, or the patient doesn't have a means of getting to the expert, then any doctor with a diploma is able, or any doctor with a diploma, and then he writes, who has received a written certification, has permission to, and had been given permission, the rapos b'miktzo'o, to treat in his field. Hagam sheyesh yoser gadol mimena b'ir. Granted that there is a greater doctor in the city. Obifrat al sugei machalot yiduot asher derech refuasam mefursemes u'mekubelas, and especially true when you're dealing with known illnesses with well-known and accepted modes of treatment. So we prefer to go with the greatest expert available. That's our, that's our preference. But realistically, that's not going to be doable. It's just not going to happen. So where there's a need for consultation, because it's not a normal case, it's not something that people know how to deal with, yes, we should be consulting. But if you can't get a hold of him, you don't say, well, therefore I'm not going to practice. If you can't get a hold of him because he can't take care of everybody, then you go with the best of your abilities. In fact, our tradition is very strong in favor of doing this kind of outside consultation where possible. I mentioned earlier the Mishnah at the end of Kiddushin, Tov Shevarofim, about the best of doctors. So the Maharsha, classic commentary to the Talmud from the 17th century, if you take a look at source number 15, the top of the last page, he says, when the Mishnah says, Tov Shevarofim LeGehinom, that the best of doctors goes to Gehenim, he says, that refers to the doctor who thinks of himself as the best. The one who says, I don't need to consult with others. So that's the one who's being criticized in that source. There's a similar idea in other writers. Just to add one more source on this, take a look at source number 16. Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef, author of the Yalkut Yosef, writes, Kishiyesh rofe yirei shamayim b'shomer mitzvos. If you have a doctor who is heaven-fearing and Torah observant, Ulaumaso, Yesh Rafe Chiloni. And then on the other hand, you have a non-observant doctor, Ach Baki Yosef Bataras Harafua, but he's more expert as a doctor. Yesh Lahadif Litapel Eitzel Harofea Baki. He says you go to the expert. You don't worry about whether he is Torah observant or not, you worry about whether he's a better doctor. That's our advice. Certainly, if you need advice on a halachic matter, then you go to a halachic authority. But in terms of getting your medical advice, you go to the best of the physicians, and so there is absolutely nothing wrong, and it is indeed right, to go seek a second opinion. Okay. Which brings us to the last of our questions. What reasons are valid reasons for rejecting medical advice in the eyes of Jewish law, in the eyes of Jewish tradition? So the first category is somebody who rejects medical advice because of halachic concerns. So the doctor says, you need to eat on Yom Kippur, and the patient doesn't want to. The doctor says, you need to go to the hospital, even though it's Shabbos. And the patient says, I don't want to go to the hospital. So here, I'd even bring you a source on the sheet in the interest of saving space for things that are actually under dispute. The Gemara in Yuma, Pei Gimel Amud Aleph, the Shulchan Aruch in Arachayim Tafresh Yud Ches, the Magen Avram in Arachayim Shin Chav Ches, Vav, the Radvaz, and so on. I can quote you a whole series of authorities. Everybody is, it's universal. They say, the patient is not allowed to decline treatment because he is concerned about Jewish law. The patient is obligated to listen to the advice of the medical expert, Asher Yebayamim Ahem, whoever that happens to be locally at that time. As a matter of fact, there's even a fascinating discussion in the Tzitz Eliezer. The question is the following. You ignored the doctor in order to do a mitzvah. Did your mitzvah count? The question that he's addressing is a case in which somebody says, I want to eat matzah on Pesach. The doctor says, you can't. It will be dangerous for you. For whatever reason, whatever condition, it will be dangerous for you to eat matzah. This is early Pesach night. The patient says, I'm eating matzah anyway. And eats the matzah. The condition clears later that night. And the doctor says, okay, now you're okay. is the patient obligated to eat matzah again because he didn't fulfill the mitzvah when he ate in violation of physician's orders? That's the question. We're not going into it in depth now. If you want, I can send you the references later for the discussion. But the point is, this is not considered to be a valid reason for rejecting medical advice. The second type of rejection, we're going to see four altogether. So the four are, number one, rejection in pursuit of a mitzvah. Number two, rejection because the patient thinks that the treatment won't be effective. Number three, rejection because the doctor acknowledges this treatment is dangerous. And therefore the patient says, I don't want it. And number four, rejection because the treatment involves pain and I don't want to go through that pain. Those are the four different justifications for rejection that I want to address. We already addressed the first one, which is the mitzvah one, rejection for the sake of a mitzvah. What about rejection because the patient thinks the treatment is not going to be effective? The doctor says, this is what you need, and the patient says, I don't believe you. So the trend is, in general, to say you have to trust the doctor. That's why the doctor is the expert. Although, there is some qualification by Rabbi Yaakov Emden in his Moreh Uktziah. Take a look at source number 17, please. This is, again, he's writing in the 18th century. And he writes, Becholi umaka shebegalui, with an illness or a wound that is visible. And by visible, he means you can see it, you can diagnose. It's considered a straightforward situation. Sheyesh l'rofe yidu avadait v'hakara b'ra bahem. The doctor has clear knowledge, a clear understanding. There's a known treatment. Ba'osek betrufa beduka u'gemura. The treatment is tested and complete. Vadai la'olam kofin l'chola ha'mesarev b'mekom sakana. So he says we definitely will compel the patient who refuses, assuming that the alternative is dangerous. He says we would actually compel the patient to undergo this where the patient is declining because he says it isn't going to work. As opposed to declining due to pain, we still have to get to. But where he's declining because he feels that it won't work. Now, the issue of compelling a patient is a very difficult one, certainly in our day, which, as someone pointed out to me the other day, is an age of patient autonomy. We don't have this idea of compelling patients to do anything. So what do you mean when you say compelling a patient? So I'm going to come back to that in a little bit when we deal with the issue of refusing due to pain or refusing due to fear of harm from the treatment. The third category of rejection is rejection because the doctor himself says, this is a dangerous treatment. We have no guarantees that you're going to survive the operation. I think this is what's good for you, but I can't guarantee anything for you. You may not make it off the table. So what do you do in a case like that? Is the patient entitled to refuse? Rabbi Moshe Feinstein dealt with this in source number 18. You can tell if you compare the Hebrew with the English that I did not translate the entire Hebrew source simply for reasons of space, but I will explain what he says. I translated the beginning. The beginning, he says, "Kisharov hu lechayim mistaber shachayov." He says, it's logical to say that if most people survive this treatment, then the patient is obligated to follow. As, in fact, the person who sent the question to Rabbi Feinstein had written. But if the odds are even, and I don't believe even means 50-50. I believe even means in the range of 50-50. If the odds are even, then he says it's logical to say we do not compel him to undergo this. He says the following. He's dealing with a case, I should have stated this at the outset. He's dealing with a case in which doctors believe that this patient is going to live short term, let's say a few weeks, but they believe with certainty that this patient is going to die after that. They are offering a surgery which they believe, if it's successful, will give that patient years of life. But if it's not successful, and they believe that it's even odds, then the patient will die on the table. The patient won't survive the operation. So that the patient has, on the one hand, a definite few weeks, as definite as we can get, or potentially long life, which could also involve not even having those few weeks. So he says, what Rabbi Feinstein writes here is, the patient is entitled to say, I'll go with the certainty of having a few weeks. I don't want to risk losing that certainty. He is entitled to do so. And then Rabbi Feinstein goes into his logic, which is the part I didn't translate. And let me explain what he says. The basis in Jewish law for risking short-term life for the sake of potential long-term life, I discussed this at the Ebola program last week at Shari Shemayim. One of the bases for this is a story that's found in Tanakh regarding four people who were staying outside of the Jewish camp. There were four people who had the spiritual disease called Sarat. What that is a topic for another time. And as a result of their condition, they were forced to live outside of the Jewish community. The Jews were at the time at war with the nation of Aram. Aram is camped opposite the Jews. These four Mitzoraim, who are outside of the Jewish population, see that it seems like the camp is abandoned. The camp of Aram is abandoned. And they ask themselves, what should we do? On the one hand, if we go there and it's a trap, we're going to get killed. On the other hand, we are starving to death, being outside of the Jewish community, and therefore, we're going to be dead in a few weeks anyway. So maybe we should, in fact, go to this camp of Aram and take the risk. We will risk our short-term life that we have now on the supplies we currently have in order to gain long-term life if it turns out that the camp is abandoned. You follow? And they, in fact, go into the camp and they find the camp is abandoned, and that's the way the story plays out. But the Talmud brings this as a basis for saying, see, you're allowed to risk short-term life for the sake of long-term survival. So Rabbi Feinstein says, what are you talking about? These four people, their identity, as understood rabbinically, is of terrible people. These are not your role models in Jewish law. Gehazi is one of them. Like, what are you, for those who know him from Tanakh, he's not a good guy. How are you relying on them to determine what you're supposed to do? They didn't go ask a rabbi whether they should go into the camp of Aram or not. So his answer is an interesting answer. His answer is, we're not really relying on them to teach me what the ruling is. The ruling is, you do whatever is normal for people. And we're bringing them as an example of what normal people do. Normal people will indeed risk their short-term existence if they're gambling for the sake of a much longer survival. That's what's dictated by that story, because we see that they did it. We're using them as psychologists, not as rabbis. And the point is, Rabbi Feinstein then says, applying it to our discussion, that if a patient says, I'm not like them, that's not my normal practice, I'm more conservative and I'd rather just know that I have my few weeks and not risk that, he's entitled to do so. It's not 100% that everybody is going to be willing to risk. So therefore, the patient is indeed entitled to reject medical advice for this purpose. Yes?
One can also see in this the Yad Hashem, because if one looks at the greater story, the beginning of the Navi.
Yeah. Yes.
So this was all Yad Hashem.
This was all true. It's all operating on the divine playing field there. And yes, by borrowing from that, we're sort of applying that elsewhere. You're right. So what we've seen then is rejection for the sake of a mitzvah is not allowed. Rejection because you think the treatment won't be effective is not allowed if the doctor is certain and has reason to be certain. Rejection because the treatment is acknowledged to be dangerous is acceptable. And then we get the last case. Rejection because this treatment is painful, this treatment involves harm, right? They're going to amputate a limb from the patient. The patient says, you know what, I'd rather not. Even if it means dying sooner, the patient would rather not undergo the amputation. So is that recognized within Jewish law? So here we get to a great difficulty, because Rabbi Moshe Feinstein believes that in the event that the patient's life is in danger without the treatment, and the treatment would actually cure the patient, so that there would not be further pain beyond this, you're not simply extending a life of pain, then he says you compel the patient. And the two sources that are relevant are brought here in sources 19 and 20. In source 19, you can see it. I'm not going to read it out loud because we're reaching the 1 hour mark. But in source number 19, Rabbi Feinstein makes the statement that we try to find doctors the patient will trust to convince the patient to undergo this this treatment and convince the patient that he has nothing to be frightened of, but otherwise we're actually going to compel the patient to undergo the treatment. The only exception he brings is in source number 20, where you're not really healing the patient, all you're doing is extending a life of pain. There he says we wouldn't compel it. And the reason I say this is difficult is because what exactly does the doctor do? What does the patient's family do in a situation like this? In other words, it's all well and good. I'm quoting you a response from Rabbi Feinstein, who is certainly an accepted halachic authority. And he is saying that we would actually compel a patient to accept a treatment. Let's take the amputation, where the amputation is known as a treatment to, in fact, cure the person of whatever it is. So there are no questions in that regard. And there will be no further physical pain from it. He's going to have to undergo the amputation. And yes, it involves psychological and emotional pain that's going to result from that. But I don't believe that's what Rabbi Feinstein is referring to here in source number 20. I could be wrong, but I don't think that's what he's referring to. So he is arguing on behalf of compelling the patient to accept the treatment. Is that something that we would actually do? So I want to distinguish between the doctor and the patient's family. When you're dealing with the patient's family, I'm not sure. I have a hard time thinking that the patient's family can compel anything anyway. In other words, when the patient says no, I think in our medical system, there's no way that the hospital is going to do it on the basis of the patient's child, even if the patient's child has power of attorney. If the patient has stated, I don't want this, I'm pretty sure that's where it's going. But what about for the doctor? Albert is saying maybe not.
Depends on capacity, the situation. It's not black and white.
Understood, it depends on capacity, but let me push the question. Let's say the patient said, being of sound mind and body, having full capacity, unquestioned capacity, put it in writing, saying, I do not want an amputation. The patient then reaches a stage of unconsciousness and incompetence. The doctor says, well, it says in the file that there should be no amputation. The patient's child, rightly or wrongly, says, I want there to be an amputation. And the child has power of attorney. Is the hospital going to do it?
Probably not.
I'm seeing a head shake no, and a probably yes.
There is no legal binding to a living will, period. Meaning you can write that under no circumstances shall I receive this treatment. And if your children, power of attorney, say the answer is go, it's go.
Interesting.
Now,
I would
in Ontario.
Actually.
In Ontario.
Okay, so 1 second, and what's the response down at the other end of the table? We have one end of the table saying that the hospital will listen to whoever holds power of attorney, and then we have...
Because the power of attorney is based on what the patient's expressed wishes were. And if the patient has expressly, when they were a sound mind and body, dictated that this was what they wanted, and they signed the forms, power of attorney forms stating this, then if the physicians are aware that this is what
actually, they can. Under Ontario law, he's quite correct. There is no binding statement that anybody can make in advance, period, full stop. But the physicians, the entire healthcare team, if there is that sort of conflict, have, under Ontario law, the ability to go to the consent and capacity board and to review that. If they believe the person is not acting in the individual's best interest. Not that they're not listening to what the person said, that they're not acting in the best interest. And that one is a really slippery slope. It is very far from black and white.
Albert is completely correct. There is a matter of time. I was involved with a patient with, she had myotonic dystrophy. She was of sound mind. She was writing notes saying, I want to die. But her son said she's not to be taken off the ventilator. And eventually it went to the board. The board agreed with the patient. She was taken off the ventilator, and she died 2 weeks later.
Okay, so in terms of the question of what the child should do, Okay, I actually sent this question away as a question to halachic authorities, and I'm waiting on a response. But again, for those who signed in, you will get a, you, when I get the answer, I will forward it to you. So make sure that you signed in, and you will receive it. But the in terms of the question for the doctor, my understanding would be, in other words, a case in which is now not between the family members. The patient said, "I don't want the amputation." The doctor feels that this is necessary in order to save the patient's life. My understanding would be that because, if only because the doctor is working in a system in which acting against the expressed wishes of the patient will lose the doctor their job, my understanding is that that's so. Therefore, it's arguable that no, they have no Jewish law obligation to go any further than trying to convince the patient. And my reason for saying that is a response of the Tzitz Eliezer, which we've discussed in other contexts, in which we note that one is not required to violate a prohibition from the Torah. I'm sorry, one is not allowed, not required to lose his job in order to keep from violating a prohibition in the Torah. In other words, the doctor has a basic prohibition here. Lo sa'amod al dam reyecha. Do not stand by as this person's blood is shed, as this person dies. You have a responsibility to intervene. However, if I understood Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg correctly, his position is that that's limited. The one would not be obligated to lose his job in order to fulfill that commandment. And because my understanding, and I'm now going to ask the doctors here whether this is true, my understanding is that an overt violation of the patient's wishes like this, doing this amputation, would cause a person to lose their medical license. That's my understanding. That's why I'm saying it as I am. Am I right?
Albert, my understanding is there have been many lawsuits for wrongful death. There's never been a successful lawsuit for wrongful life.
Oh, no, there are in the OB field. There are in the obstetrics field. It's not 100% black and white. There is a very strong supervisory mechanism. It is entirely possible that you would lose your license for having done that. But nothing is 100% black and white. What you would for sure lose your license about is if your values conflict with those of the patient and you use your values to override the patient.
Right, which is what
then
we're talking about.
Then for sure you'll lose it.
Right. And that's what we're talking about in this
no,
case.
No, not quite.
Why?
Patient doesn't want their leg amputated. You're, as a health practitioner, convinced that capacity is in doubt here. Or better yet, forget amputation. Patient has meningitis. I don't want to have antibiotics. They don't have antibiotics. They're going to die. There are cases where the entire healthcare team has overridden the individual in that emergency, treated them against their will, been called up, and been, quote, exonerated because the person wasn't fully capable.
Right.
The argument is over capacity.
Right.
And there are lots of times that we argue over capacity where I will say, this one isn't, and somebody else will say, this one is.
Right.
And that's where you'll get caught.
Okay. No, I hear that. I hear that. Right.
In most cases, they get the transfusion.
But that's also because they're children.
In court.
But that's because they're children. If they were adults, then they would be entitled to decline. Jordan?
One thing that comes up, I think, more in popular culture now is about vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
Is this consistent with this? It's not active treatment, it's preventative treatment, and it's based on reasonable science.
Yeah. So
the same thing where people can actually refuse certain vaccinations.
So let me just sum up the rejection of treatment and then come back to the vaccination question. But in terms of the justifications for rejection, and if people have to go understood, just make sure that you signed in. But the rejection for halachic reasons is not acceptable. Rejecting medical advice because you think it won't work, the treatment will not be effective. So we generally, assuming this is an area where the doctor should understand and should know, it's a clear case, we go with we go with what the doctor says and even compel the patient. Rejecting because the doctor himself says, yeah, this is a dangerous treatment, so the patient is entitled to reject it. rejecting because I don't want to go through the pain or the harm that's going to come with the treatment, assuming it's a treatment that actually will heal the patient and not involve further pain and illness from this afterwards, then indeed we try to get the patient to agree, and that's that compulsion case that we discussed at the end. So now to go back to Jordan's question about vaccinations, my understanding is that at this stage, we consider the, and this is my understanding, but we consider the medical opinion, the consensus medical opinion, to be that the standard vaccinations are effective and are safe. And because of that, I would put that in the category of the patient who rejects because the patient thinks it won't be effective, or worse, the patient thinks that it's actually harmful, and say that as Rabbi Yaakov Emden did, and as many, many halachic authorities did, that where this is something where the doctor can reasonably claim to know what he's talking about, the patient does not have the right to refuse. I would add to that that when you're dealing with vaccinations, it's not just the individual involved, but it's potential harm to others. By refusing the vaccination, one could potentially, and we've already, I'm sure you've all seen the articles debunking the argument of, well, if only I don't get vaccinated, then everybody's, we know that that's not true. And reality has shown that to be the case. So in addition to the patient not being entitled to forfeit their own safety, the patient is certainly not entitled to forfeit the safety of the community. That's based on my understanding of vaccinations. If my understanding of vaccinations is wrong, then everything I've just said is wrong. But that's my understanding based on what I've read.
Covered by the open, and certain ones are more formally recommended and paid for, and other ones are still...
Right, so whatever is reckoned, OHIP isn't, I think I can say that OHIP is not the standard for what's considered an accepted or not accepted medication. No, because I could see making the argument differently. I could see making the argument differently that sort of is the standard, but I don't think so, because it's based on economics as well as medicine.
What about refusing chemotherapy?
So we have some high-profile cases within the halachic community from the last 30, 40, 50 years of rabbis, great authorities, who indeed declined chemotherapy at the end of their life. And their argument was that it really, if I remember correctly, and I can't quote chapter and verse on this, but if I remember correctly, the argument was that the doctors themselves were saying this isn't going to extend a functional life, and therefore they were entitled to say, it's not really a healing treatment. All it's going to do is extend pain without providing something useful, and on that basis they were able to decline.
That's a very, very individual decision.
Oh, I'm not denying
not
that.
Black.
But I'm saying that there is such a thing in the halachic system as declining chemotherapy. It really requires, though, more in-depth discussion. As does the last point that I discussed, this issue of rejecting because of, of compelling a patient. I want to get those answers from the authorities I consulted on that and communicate them around, because I think they're important.
Reference 20 years is a whole year, not a whole week.
Yes. Correct. Absolutely agreed. Thank you very much.